Good morning, Sue. It's Al McNeil in Claire's home. I'm testing out a very old tape recorder here and a very old memory. I want to send you this tape because I was reading online last night regarding Poker Flats, the problems that Neil Davis had and various other people, and it brought back a lot of memories which perhaps might joggle a few other memories up there about the early days of Poker Flats. I do recall that Neil Davis in 65 or somewhere in there, no, a little later than that, was extremely interested in establishing the Poker Flats Rocket Range. There were so many difficulties trying to get the government to approve this, that, and the other. He was having all kinds of troubles, and that in turn brought on another story, which I will start in a moment. But first of all, I definitely remember the call would go out, we need crews at Poker Flats today, and if you aren't doing anything, get out there. And my first sight of Poker Flats was simply a large, partially cleared opening in the trees. And back in those days, we just called it Chattanooga. Poker Flat might have come along a little later, but it was Chattanooga to us, and what it was a vast open area, which, to tell you the truth, was mostly floating. It was bog, permafrost, ice prisms. I can remember trucks, all four wheels buried right to their hubs. I particularly have a vision in my mind of Eldon Thompson. I think this was back possibly before Neil Brown actually became too involved. But Eldon Thompson was the wild driving force, and he was a wild man. There's no doubt about it. He kept everybody incredibly busy. But I remember him racing across the area on a snow machine because it was the only thing that wouldn't sink through the permafrost and into the mud. he was racing around giving orders and getting things done. But at that time, it was simply an open field. And so anyway, I knew it was pretty common knowledge that Neil was having some serious difficulties with the government, and he was having difficulty lining up the scientific community behind him, because there was some doubt, like, you know, we're firing rockets from Churchill, it's kind of working, and we're going to get kicked out of Greenland. But things were not, you know, it wasn't a go-to fact. The people just weren't that convinced in the scientific community that maybe this would work. So what I'm going to do is lead you into another little story concerning Fort Churchill, Dr. Akasafu, and something that happened up there, which made, in my poor old mind, it made a huge difference. And I have to warn you that this happened many, many years ago, and I may have it screwed up quite a bit. But anyway, this is basically what happened. At the time, Dr. Akasafu and I and 32 other experimenters were flying around the North Pole in the NASA airship called the Galileo. We were stationed in Fort Churchill, and I had five cameras on board. We did this in 68 and 69, and I had five cameras which pointed out to the sides, and also all sky cameras pointed straight up through the roof of the airplane. And we simply flew around and looked for aurora. We went to places like Thule, Greenland, Bodø, Norway, all over the north, a lot of time over the North Pole. And we incidentally were aboard the Galileo the night that the B-52 bomber crashed off the end of the runway in Thule. And we actually had to, we landed 15 minutes later and had to fly through the radioactive cloud and land in Thule, where we were not very welcome at all. We spent an entire day up there, which was one of the weirdest days of my life, and that's a whole nother story. But that was the beginning of the reason that the U.S. was kicked out of Thule. One of the reasons, because, of course, they didn't know at that time how much it was going to cost to clean up all the mess. And as we landed, people were simply standing around waiting for another one of these hydrogen bombs to cook off and totally eliminate everybody. But as I say, that's another story. So anyway, one of our purposes, as you will see from the thing that Colleen's sending along with us, we were to coordinate an aerial and rocket shot at the same time at Churchill. The idea was that, I'm sorry, I cannot remember the name of the university that was firing the rockets. They were very famous. They were going to fire a rocket from Fort Churchill. We and the Galileo were going to fly underneath it with all of our instruments pointed up at where this rocket was going. Sounded like a heck of a good plan. We were delayed several days by bad weather, but finally the plan was laid out. We and the Galileo would circle about 20 miles away from the rocket site, as the countdown, we would keep track of the countdown until the rocket was fired. Unfortunately, the Department of Transport in Canada is a bunch of morons, was a bunch of morons. They refused to allow us to talk to the rocket range directly. Our only communication was through the Department of Transport radio operator in Churchill, who in turn was on the telephone to the rocket range. So what happened was, we were flying around in a big circle around the range. The countdown started. The radio operator kept us informed. The countdown went down to 1 minute, and at that point the pilots of our airplane turned and headed in towards the rocket site. The rocket would go off about 45 seconds before we got there. The second stage would have fallen to the ground. We would pass directly under the trail of the rocket and record everything we saw. Didn't work that way. When the countdown reached 1 minute, the radio operator in Churchill ran outside to watch the rocket go up. When the countdown reached 30 seconds, a 1 minute hold was called. We did not know this, and there we were boring in at 400 miles an hour, or headed for the rocket site. Now, from here on, things got hushed up pretty much, but I knew one of the pilots well. He was a a former pilot for Ween Alaska Airlines, and we did have a talk. Apparently what happened was, as we bored into the rocket site, the rocket went off right in front of us. Could have been a lot closer. Nobody knows. The pilot immediately slammed our aircraft into a tremendous right turn to get out of the way of the falling second stage. And we just turned around and headed right back to the airport and said, that's it, we're done. So, anyway, what happened was the next morning, a general meeting was called of all rocket participants, all airplane participants, all scientists. Everybody was called into the main, it was a dining room in Fort Churchill. And sitting around the table with all of us from the airplane, myself included, and Shun, and the rocket people, the pilots, there must have been 40 or 50 people. Everybody was just, if you'll pardon the language, extremely pissed off. And so the conversation started up. Mainly the pilots expressed themselves very vehemently how they absolutely would never do this again, period. And the fellow who was firing the rocket, Shun will recognize the picture of him and know who it is. He said, well, it kind of wasted a rocket, didn't it? You didn't get any data. And on and on, the rocket scientists complained bitterly about the horrible amounts of paperwork the Canadian Customs forced them to do, the delays in getting their stuff to Fort Churchill because the railway only ran once in a while at best, the things like what had happened the previous night, just a simple one man screwed up and it could have killed all 32 of us on the airplane very easily. So everybody was extremely upset, raging about, you can't get anything done here. And at that point, Shun kind of stood up or stepped up to the conversation and said, well, we're building a rocket range at Poker Flat. Why don't you all get behind us and give us all of the scientific community's best efforts to help us out. And that's exactly what happened. I think the fact that whoever this guy was who was firing the rocket had great influence in the States. Dr. Akasufu had great influence. And I think that perhaps that was a turning point. Everybody said, well, we can't fire rockets here anymore. It's too dangerous. It's too difficult. Let's all shift over to Poker Flats. So we'll put our very fullest efforts towards helping the Geophysical Institute get this thing done. And I think within, perhaps 8 months, we were firing rockets. And it just kept going from there. The weird story on the Galileo and Thule Greenland, it's probably of no interest to anyone, but I'm going to stick it in here just for documentary purposes. We had left Churchill. We were due to land in Thule Greenland, which of course was a secret U.S. Strategic Air Command base, and we had to get permission. And all the way over there, every 30 minutes, we had to call Thule and say, do we still have permission to land? Because it was a long flight, and it took all the fuel we had. So we proceeded on and on and on, calling in, do we still have permission to land? Yep, come ahead. Kept going until we were possibly 30 minutes out of Thule and starting to descend to land. We called in and said, still got permission to land? The tower came back and said, nope, your landing permission is canceled. Go away. Well, we were kind of in a bad place. We had flown all night to get there. As far as I remember, we were very low on fuel. Well, not very low, but lower than we should have been, because we had planned all the way that we would be landing in Thule and refueling there. So when we got a refusal, we were in trouble. We didn't have enough fuel to go back to Churchill. And I believe, now this is strictly classified, I believe the pilots got into a real hassle with Thule Tower saying, well, we can't go anywhere, we've got to land there, or you can come out and pick us up off the ice, whatever you like. But eventually, very reluctantly, we got the word, okay, you can come and land in Thule, but we have to advise you that very special conditions exist, and you'll be at risk. Now, the special conditions were that the B-52 bomber ahead of us had crashed on the end of the runway with four hydrogen bombs on it. It was burning merrily, and they were expecting one of these hydrogen bombs to cook off any second. There were four of them, and we had to fly in. There's only one approach to Thule Greenland. We had to fly in through the cloud of smoke and radioactive debris that was rising up from the wreckage. So we did so. And then things started happening like crazy. They parked us on the runway. Instantly there was a bus there. Grab whatever you need for the night, and they took us to the far end of the airport. As I said, everyone was just scared to death that the whole airport was going to vanish any moment. They took us to the far end of the airport to the most cruddy, god-awful barracks I've ever been in my life. The toilets had 4 inches of ice on the walls and told us to bed down there. They allowed us to sleep for, I don't know, 2 or 3 hours. Suddenly they were back in our faces screaming at us, get up, get up, you got to go back. So we got up, packed again. They put us on a bus and they took us down and gave us a very nice, very leisurely breakfast. I have no idea what time of the day it was. Of course, it was always dark up there. But I recall sitting just across the aisle from us was the commandant of the base and the pilot of the airplane who had crashed. And they were having a debriefing right there in the breakfast room. Pilot looked like he was really in rough shape. I think he was the only one that got out alive. Anyway, after the very nice breakfast, they hustled us out to our airplane, which apparently they had washed in a hangar during the night, and put us on board, and there we sat for 12 hours. The pilots finally got one engine started up, so at least we had heat and air conditioning, but then they found out that they couldn't refuel us with us. They didn't have the correct connectors. They didn't have the correct ground electrical units to plug into us. So we sat and sat and sat and sat. A lot of us were sick. We had the flu, so it was not fun. But eventually, there was one aircraft landing every 30 seconds with emergency crews, so on and so forth. Apparently, the hydrogen bomb didn't go off. So, but eventually, we got the use of the runway. We took off and went back to Churchill, and that was the end of that. But Chun may remember it, he may not, but it was certainly a very weird day. If I think of anything else, I'll add to this, but I think I'm kind of running out of tape on this side. Susan, Colleen has just produced 4 prints for me to include with this tape, one of which will help to clarify what I'm talking about. It's a photograph of Dr. Akasafu and the very large gentleman who was firing the rocket that we were supposed to track. I'm sure Shun will be able to tell you immediately who he was, but it's just a little publicity blip which talks about precision and a precision flyby and all that stuff, which of course didn't happen. Anyway, it's a picture of Shun and this other doctor, which you can show to him if you'd like, and perhaps it will jog his memory of the entire event. She's also found a picture of the big triangle building at Poker Flat, which is about really the only thing we have that documents anything on Poker Flat. She's also included a couple of shots. Davis got the idea of buying these gigantic 10-inch aerial cameras, mounting them in a mount so they would look upward. We put 2 of them on Esther Dome, and I think we put 1 at Fort Churchill, no, 1 at Fort Yukon, and several others. And we operated these cameras with color transparency film, believe it or not. 500-foot color transparency film rolls, and they took one picture every 5 seconds, generally. They were all connected up to each other via landline so that they all fired at the same instant. So there's a couple of pictures here of yours truly up at that site running these cameras. We literally had to keep them warm up until the last second, take them out and whip them onto the mounts and start them up when the barium rocket shots were fired. It was extremely cold. But anyway, just another little note which I'll include with these. Now, we're making up, of course, we have 135mm slides. Colleen is scanning and making a whole bunch more prints of various activities around the Institute. Actually, a lot of it will be duplicates, but you'll be able to see it a lot better. And I'm going through the box of the 4x5 negatives, which I will label very carefully. They may or may not be of any use to you, but in any case, all of that information will be arriving at a later date. But I thought that this stuff concerning the rocket range and my memories of it should get to you right away so you can get started. Guess that's about it. I'll add more later if necessary. Yes, yes. Another thought that just popped up. We very seldom ever saw the results of what we did on these, what we photographed on these barium rocket experiments. We actually, believe it or not, had to take the rolls of film out of these great big cameras, excuse me, and take them to the lab. Boy, I'm talking too much. I'm losing my voice. We had to take the film out of these big cameras, take them to the lab, to our own laboratory, and develop them, 500-foot rolls, 10 inches wide. You can't believe the difficulty of something like that. And I cannot remember ever being allowed to see what was on them. Almost all of the photographic data that was produced from these rocket shots instantly vanished. Probably had to do with the fact that it was, top secret anti-nuclear device tests. But I just thought I'd throw that in, which is why I have very little myself, and I doubt that anyone has too much information, too much actual data. It was all immediately made to disappear. So, Susan, I think that's probably about it. We have gone through just about all of my files. The only thing that I have left is two or 300 scenery and aurora shots on 2 1/4 transparency. I don't think they really would be of any use to you whatsoever. So, in the meantime, Colleen is busy scanning and taking pictures out of her scrapbook, and all that information will be forwarded to you at a later date. Thank you. Just a further note, Susan, we are desperately looking for big reel-to-reel tape recorders so we can find and send to you the live broadcast of the first rocket launch. I believe it was radio station CKUA made it, but we have to find a tape recorder and find to sort it out. That's going to take a little while, but that also will be included in the next package, we hope.